Hi everyone, and welcome to the Cover Mindset podcast with McGinley Coaching. I'm your host and founder, Laurie McGinley. Today we're joined by Kevin Murphy. How are you, Kevin?
I'm great, Laurie. Thank you very much for asking me on as well. Privileged to be on the podcast, so appreciate the invite.
No worries at all. Can you just tell the listeners a bit about background of yourself and the kind of coaching journey and the kind of the job you're in at the moment?
Sure, hopefully I'll try to keep it quite short. Started coaching since at school, really, at high school, age 16. Done that all through university and stuff like that as well. During that time, I coached for the St Lancia Leisure at the time, doing community coaching as well at Motherwell, doing the community coaching. From that, I then started to do work at Hamilton Accies women's team. I was only 20 years of age, I think, when I was doing that. And then I started to pick up more work within the SFA, so I became a football development officer for Eastern Bartonshire Leisure at that time, where I employed you, yeah. If you remember.
Yeah, a long time ago.
So obviously I'm a good coach when I see one. So I did a bit of that, and then I got the opportunity to, I was then coached at Rangers Women, and got the opportunity to then go full-time at Rangers, doing the academy, as well as the women's first team, so did that for a while. And then that took me to Manchester City to the technical director role, then back up to Hearts to head up the women's programme at Hearts, then back to Rangers as the academy manager and assistant coach in the women's first team, and then to Arsenal where I am now as the recruitment lead for the women's team.
And through the kind of roles that you've had, it's obviously worked at kind of grassroots to kind of professional level. But see throughout the kind of times we mentioned off air about kind of different things that have happened through like the years of coaching, but also learning and the biggest thing is everyone wants to go to the top right away, but sometimes it's actually learning your trade at the bottom, volunteering, asking for help. And through the kind of the roles of a development officer to a TD to recruitment, you would always have to do a lot of learning, but a lot of kind of networking too, to make sure that you're saying the right things and doing the kind of don't say boring stuff, but the things that are a bit more the admin side. How do you try and balance these things out?
Probably not very well, to be honest with you, when I first started. I think when you're young and enthusiastic, like you said, I volunteered for various different things and I was doing that for years, and fortunately enough after that you started to pick up paid work on a casual basis, and that was all your recreational community activity. And then, as I said, I then got the opportunity to then coach at Hamilton Accies on the women's team, so I was doing a senior women's team, and then also the following day or the following night, and then coaching mini kickers at 5 and 6, so that was really good for me as a coach to develop, because you're getting all spectrums there very early on in my coaching career. And I've gravitated to women's football. I loved it. I loved the mentality that they had. It was obviously amateur at the time, and they would train 2 nights a week, which then quickly went 4 nights a week. So I felt as a coach I was learning on the job very, very quickly. I was getting a lot of coaching hours in at that point because we had a lot of time on the pitch. And I just felt that I grew and developed. So within that, you start to get developing opportunities. You meet other coaches, you go to different seminars and conferences, and you work your way up the coaching ladder in terms of qualifications as well. And I think I have a different take on what a lot of people say. A lot of people say that, you get your coaching certificate and then you take a couple of years, you put it in practice and then you go again at the next one. But I had a different take. I wasn't chasing the certificate. I was just chasing the knowledge and the learning opportunities as well as the networking opportunities that brought. So I kind of tried to move up the kind of coaching qualification ladder fairly quickly, but it wasn't just to get to the top qualification as soon as I could. It was more to do with me trying to put myself out of my comfort zone, learn from other people, learn from the courses, and then test myself within the environments I was working in. So I think all of that helps shape you and develop you as a coach and gives you different experiences for some of the roles that I've then went on to do.
Yeah, because on top of kind of formal education, it's like through like the SFA, but also UEFA, but also doing like informal qualifications, like doing something to do with scouting, to do with talent ID. Do you think having that kind of formal education is great, but as you said, it's the knowledge sometimes of other qualifications and even things that are not even qualified, you know, like going to matches, going to speak to different people, that informal information actually builds up more, and then once you actually have that information, you can actually put it on the knowledge part, you know, in your assessments. But it doesn't make you a bad coach if you've actually only got like a B license, but you've actually done 30 years of experience, but then you may just not want to, you may not have the finance to pay for an A license, you might not have the time, might not have the just the desire, but you want to maybe do like a head of recruitment or something like that, a different kind of role. But do you think that's a big thing now that a lot of coaches are kind of struggling with? They want to go up to the ladder and then they realise, oh, I've done this, but I don't know how to deal with the other side of the game a little bit more.
Yeah, 100%, and I agree with that. Because you have a pro licence or a B licence, the pro licence doesn't make you necessarily a better coach. It gives you a degree of competency, of course, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're actually better at your trade. And like you touched upon, I think the ability to continue to learn, to get information from other people, to apply that and have that kind of growth mindset approach to things is really important. And we're very fortunate in the era that we live in that you can have CPD at the touch of a button now, whether it's a podcast like yourself, whether it's reading books, whether it's picking up the phone and speaking to a coach or going onto YouTube. So there's various different ways of what you can do now to learn. And I think for me, even just going onto different branches, whether it be psychology or sports science, and so you can start to learn not just your own craft, but also what makes you more informed as a coach to work in a multidisciplinary team as well, so you can start to branch off to those areas and start to become, you know, certainly not a specialist, but start to get more informed information so that when you're talking to these people who are, you can hold those conversations and you can do it with a degree of confidence because you've put the work in. So, yeah, I think it's one that if anyone was listening that's starting out coaching, the journey's theirs and everyone will be different. I had a different approach to it to someone else. It doesn't mean that my approach was right. But I think it's just important that everyone's always continuing to learn and be the best version of themselves as a coach or whatever path they want to then choose, and then apply that and continue to grow every single time rather than, as you say, have a qualification and then not learn for 20, 30 years. That doesn't mean that you're getting any better, does it? So I think it's really important that no matter what field you're in, but certainly within our coaching field, that you've got to make sure that you apply yourself to continue learning throughout your whole career.
Yeah, and you look at like I was listening to something a couple weeks ago, and it was regarding like a coach, but he's like, he wants to go and speak to the sports scientist, the psychologist, it's not the head of coaching he wants to speak to. He wants to speak to the fitness instructor, the nutritionist, so they can, because everyone wants to go and speak to the top people who make decisions in the football. But what about the support staff? You know, can you go and, as you said, if you can go and pick your brains of these people, you know, like one of my friends went to Real Madrid, and the first thing he said is, I want to see the psychologist. I want to see how they work. I want to see how the children's coach works. How does the 1v1 specialist work? You know, do you think that's a good thing as a coach to develop that trade of asking awkward questions to the people that are who are going to give you more of an answer, you know, like they'll give you more time? Because again, everyone wants to go to the coaches, and sometimes it's good to speak to the support people around them, so therefore they can, you know, maybe they want to go to be a sports scientist, you know, but still have that kind of coaching background, you know, to help themselves.
I think you need to be a general specialist, don't you? Yeah. You have to know everything, and I think being a coach, you have to be curious, like you've said there. I think that's really fundamental. So if you think about coaching, if there's any coaches, you're all those things in a session, aren't you? You're a coach, you're a psychologist, because you've got to motivate, you've got to have emotional intelligence to know when people need picked up or when they need help or how to communicate with those people, given their mood or their circumstances. You have to be a sports scientist because you're going to have to give them activity that's going to get them to a certain threshold physically. So you're having to do all these jobs as a coach. So I think it's really important that, yes, you'll have experts in those fields, but if you're a coach and you're serious about your trade, that you've got to then go and ask these people that know more than you and be comfortable with that. And I think when I was doing the TD role at Man City and then obviously the academy roles at Rangers and Hearts, that was a real advantage to me because I could go into meetings with sports science or a psychologist or a nutritionist and have a degree of knowledge that I can hold a conversation and I can ask questions. And I think to do that, it makes the programme better. They also enjoy that because they can get a bit of a two-way conversation and we can test each other out with different things we want to try to do. And I think that's really important. So I think that helped certainly my development, doing those roles and having that kind of growth mindset to try to learn what other people's areas are. I think that's really important. So I think there's a real strength in being a specialist generalist, or however you want to put it. Like, having a little bit of knowledge about a lot of things can have a real advantage sometimes, because I think the way that the world's going just now, if you just go down one rabbit hole and you're very, very focused on that, yes, that brings advantages, but I think it's quite limiting as well, and it has its limitations. So I think it's important to try to branch out as much as you can and have an eye on different areas that impact your role, whatever that may be.
Yeah, so look at your role in the moment, you know, in Arsenal. You know, again, congratulations on the win. It's a big team effort. But from the, you look at the, a lot of coaches, you know, look at like the recruitment. They look at the, when things go well, they always say, oh, it's usually the manager, but it's the recruitment, it's a team. But when things go wrong, you know, like the, it's the usual first person to blame is recruitment or the other side. From your experience, you know, in the kind of the game, you know, from kind of Rangers, Hearts and Man City, and even at Arsenal, how do you try and deal with the upper management, you know, when things go wrong, you know, or not, if you've not got the right balance, you know, sometimes because you've got managers who come in and they just very much focus on first team, and then you've got other managers or head coaches who want to focus on the youth, you know, but they want to see how the next generation works. Again, you're looking at maybe professional level, but even grassroots level, you know, working even in Scotland and England, you know, how do you try and manage the expectations to the board, but also expectations to the manager? Because you're in the kind of, in a win-win or a lose-lose situation sometimes, and it must be difficult as the kind of senior position.
It's a great question, Laurie, and I think what's really important, and you're right in what you're saying, you'll have little snippets of people, whether it's in media or social media, that would, you know, like to label managers or people that's, you know, head of the organisation or head of recruitment and label that, but the reality of it is, it is a real collective decision, and it's not one person makes those final decisions. So in terms of managing up the way, I've been fortunate enough to work at clubs that have got a real idea of who they are and what they are as football clubs and what their identity is and their DNA. So that kind of cascades all the way down to your operations and what you do, whether it's as a coach, whether it's your game model, whether it's recruitment strategy and policy. So you've got that overarching philosophy of the club. Then underneath that, you'll always have a manager that has a style of play who he or she wants them to play. And then you drill that down further, you've then got positional profiling and how the manager sees each position, what that looks like. And that helps steer people within recruitment, for example, to then what sorts of players. Because as you know, as the game evolves, a fullback can be three or four different types now. Mm-hmm. A fullback isn't just a fullback that plays in the side of the pitch that defends and occasionally attacks. You can get all sorts of different profiles now of a fullback, for one example. So you have to be really clear and really detailed from management of what that criteria looks like and what they are wanting and what they expect you to bring. And then you then do your due diligence through your scouting, through your data, and making sure you've got that. I think that's really important. And then from that perspective, it's then a group decision. You present what you've found in terms of profiles and players and what the availability is, and it's a group decision. And then after that, you hope that it works. But I think that's the unique thing about recruitment. There is no exact science or exact formula to say that this is going to work. There is so many different factors. I mean, you're dealing with human beings. There's just not an exact science to it, and that's what makes it really fascinating. And you just hope, in the line of work that I do, that you get more right than you do get wrong. And if you do that, then you're doing an extremely good job, because for a lot of people it might seem easy, but it is a difficult job with a lot of complexity, and you've got to get that balance right that you mentioned.
Yeah, and talking about, I think we've talked about this kind of earlier, but obviously having that kind of different roles of learning, you know, of formal learning and speaking, maybe speaking a different language, just obviously is a big thing now, because everyone seems to knows a second language, you know, as a kind of a base, it's usually Spanish or German or French. But from your you talk about framework, you know, and the kind of DNA. Is this something that, see, when we get older, you know, we start to just look at more specific stuff, you know, like the, I want to look at maybe, you said, as I said, the job you're in is very good, but from the experience of being a TD, working the admin side, working, basically being in the women's game for a long time, you get to know what's needed and what's not needed. But do you sometimes, you said you there's a collective, but you have to trust yourself, and we sometimes, in Britain, you know, the UK, we really are negative about things. When we look at a job and we look at players and think, is that good enough? I'm not good enough, you know, in that mindset. Is it good having a team of people around you to basically, if you're not you're not 100% sure, as you work with humans, but you have to have that collective, you know, way of thinking. So there is a framework, and you go in together as a win, and sometimes, as they say, you lose. But as I said, do you think having the three or four big roles that you've had has actually helped you become more confident in watching players, watching managers, watching people, but then having the ability to back that information up with, you know, data, but also human eyes? Because at the end of the day, you can have so much data in front of you, but if the data tells you one thing and your eyes see a different thing, sometimes it sometimes can be difficult to break that down and have that say to the management, I like this player because of this, I've seen it for many years, but they're raw, but it's still not there. The data kind of tells you one thing and another thing. How do you try and convince the people around you to maybe take a gamble, or is it sometimes good to play it safe and then maybe have that year looking at them again, you know, from a fresh point of view, from another, you know, point of, like another person who's maybe non-judgment, you know?
It's a good question. I think you've got to be authentic. I think you're right. I've been involved in women's football for 19 years, and I've seen the expansion and explosion of women's football over that time, year on year, and I feel that I'm very knowledgeable about women's football because it's my space. It's what I've been in for so long, and I've dedicated so much time to it. So there's a degree of conviction and confidence when I put a player forward, but it's not my role to put my neck on the line in terms of you should sign this player. It's my job to put a list in front of the decision makers to say, well, these are the players that we think are more suitable. I give an opinion on each of those players, an honest opinion on those players, and then it's up to all of us as a collective to make a decision. And we don't always agree on those decisions. At every club I've worked with, I would lie to say that every single decision we've made in terms of recruiting players into a football club, we've all been aligned. Doesn't always necessarily be the case, but you have to then respect those other decision makers if they've got a different opinion. But you know, if you're presenting, say, three players in a position, you're comfortable with all three of those players, and that's why you're presenting them in front of those people. And maybe you have a preference, that's, you know, that's number one in your preference, and maybe in the meeting that player isn't the one that they perceived to be their number one, and you've got to live with that as well. That's okay. And I just think you've got to be authentic, you've got to be honest. And in the position that I am in now, I think it's really important that you just have a degree of confidence in your conviction in terms of what, you know, you say about data. I think you're right. I think data is there to inform you, but it's not there to lead you. I think that's really important. I think that's so important in recruitment, that it's there to help inform you, but it shouldn't be there to give you the final decisions. I think that is a key thing. I think you've got to still rely on your eyes, your experiences, and all the other factors when you're dealing with human beings that you've got to take into the equation when that comes to it. I think in summary, you've got to be confident in your convictions, you've got to do your due diligence, but you've also then got to make sure that you're given a variety of players that fit the criteria. And that you, when you present that to the decision makers, you know that either one, two, or three you're happy with, even though that you might have some unconscious bias towards certain players. You've got to put that, or try to put that aside, and let other people make those decisions, with me then informing them my observations and be comfortable with that no matter what they decide.
Yeah, because that comes from experience, but also comes from the kind of knowledge of the game and knowing who to speak to and not to speak to. You know, like, obviously there's people in the game who have got very good knowledge, but you just might not have the right information. But this is another thing that was interesting. See, a lot of coaches, from your experience, you've seen a lot of good coaches and some not so good coaches, and different things are happening. But do you think sometimes we sometimes look down a little bit, like we see if there's a grassroots coach that seems good, but because they're not a label, you know what I mean, like a, I don't want to say like an Arsenal or Chelsea, you know, they've, you look at the big names and everyone looks at these kind of clubs and say, oh, these guys are the top of the range, when there could be a grassroots kind of coaching who's very good but might not have that, again, finance could be a barrier. Is it good to, when you're looking to, you know, because you obviously you recruit the lead, but also you've been in the kind of coaching world and you've seen a lot, how do you try and identify different coaches that you've probably looked at, you know, and thought, you know what, this person's really good, or how would I help mentor that young coach? Because a lot of coaches you see in the last 10 years, everyone seems to have done the football degree, you know, and it's been great, but it's just started to very saturated. I'm just looking to see what you would probably look at young coaches, but also coaches that are maybe at a crossroads, you know, they've got a good bit of knowledge, a bit of experience, but they're not really sure what they want to do. And again, the second part is, you talked about it in kind of one of the podcasts I was listening to about burnout. If we chase things all the time, we're going to just go berserk, you know, and like we're just going to crash and burn. I'm just wondering how you would try and help this kind of burnout, but also the kind of advice for coaches that maybe are at that crossroads, you know, to maybe look at different parts of the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when I was in positions where I was recruiting coaches, I think I didn't really care too much about the qualifications. Of course, it had to be a certain level of qualification a lot of the time, because you had to, through licensing and stuff like that, they had to have a certain level. So you had to make sure they had a minimum level of qualification for them to obviously apply for the job. However, once you've went through CVs and you start to meet with people, both in an interview setting as well as on the pitch, for me it was about their personality. That was the most important thing, because I felt that as a coach you can help them progress and get better in coaching, but it's very difficult to change someone's personality. So I would always look for people with a growth mindset. I've said that already a lot, but that's really important. Someone who wants to get better all the time, who's willing to take on feedback, but who can also challenge it too. I think that's also important. It's not that, you know, I'm the fountain of all knowledge and I know everything. No, the opposite. People can come back and challenge me, and you can have that environment. I think it's really important. And a healthy way, of course. So that was really big for me, as well as enthusiasm and commitment. So they have to love what they do. That has to shine through in what they do, their interaction with not just the players, but with the parents and other staff. And then how well organised they were in the planning stages, I thought was really important. So if I got the sense of that through interviews, and we've always done like 3-stage interviews a lot of the time, you start to then get a good feel for what that person is like, not just in the coaching field, but away from that as well. So I was really big on personality traits rather than the qualifications, albeit you knew that obviously that had a degree of importance. So I think that was really important. What was your second part to the question, Laurie?
Yeah, the kind of crossroads, you know, because you've got people who have experience and they're struggling a lot of it, because there's so many good coaches out there, but they don't have. They look at barriers like finance. You know, you're expecting sometimes to go 4 nights a week for free. You know, and it's like, how do you? Is there a better way of spending your time to educate yourself to maybe become that more?
It's difficult, and I used to wrestle with that. I always found it was harder to manage part-time staff than full-time staff, because your part-time staff might only be getting paid for 10 hours a week. The reality is they're probably doing about 15 hours a week on top of that, and then they had full-time jobs, they had families, etc., etc. So you also have to try to be mindful and constant of the fact that they have other things out with their coaching responsibilities for you. So just simple things for me. It was important not to pester people during the day because I was working full time. But if I'm phoning someone, they're probably working somewhere else or they've got a bit of time off before they go into their coaching. So I was making sure that you tried to respect people's time and you tried to only pester them within the kind of working hours of when you had them, if that makes sense. And also try to manage their expectations in terms of the load. So, you know, you'd often work with another coach. So it was important that they tried to share responsibilities within the coaching as well, you know. So if one was uploading the sessions on the system, the other one was then doing maybe some of the player reports, so it wasn't falling on the same person all the time, because very quickly, as I said, those 10 hours become 15 hours, become 20 hours in a week, and then that's when you get the burnout and you're getting then people doing all these hours and not getting compensated for it, which is obviously a big thing. I think we're in an issue at the moment where you have so many people who want to be into coaching, and sometimes organisations can take advantage of that. We've seen it with other industries as well, where they'll advertise all these roles with massive job specs, but they're either voluntary or they're internships, and they absolutely have their place. Like, I started as a volunteer, so I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but it's making sure that there's a pathway there within that organisation that can lead to something that's more secure, I think, is really important. And I think the other thing about coaching, as you said, if they can't maybe afford to go up the coaching ladder in terms of qualifications, one thing I think is really important that we don't do that well in football is having mentors and making sure that you have someone that you can call upon that can maybe watch your sessions, or you can get them on the phone and you can have conversations with them. I think that's so important for someone's journey to have someone like that. And it might even be your coaching buddy, you know, the person that you're coaching with, that you can maybe mentor each other, or it could be someone else that maybe you've met in a coaching course or something like that, that you have a degree of respect and trust with. I think that's really important. But when I speak to a lot of coaches, we don't have a lot of mentors, people that we can call upon and learn from. I think that's something that, again, I would love to see getting introduced more formally. But even just informally, I think that's what coaches can do to help themselves too. I think that's massive.
Yeah, well, I've got 30 seconds of two questions in it. So one, well, I've got a minute, but you talk about mentors there. Do you think it's good actually having a mentor that's not in the field of football, actually a different kind of sport?
It can be. In fact, even through COVID, I started a little group with high-performing coaches from a variety of different sports. So rugby union, cricket, hockey. For that very reason, I think you can learn from other sports and be greedy. Why not have two? Why not have one in your field and one out with your field? I think that would only bring benefits rather than negatives.
And the kind of final question is mindset. What does that kind of mean to you? How would you describe your mindset? I know growth, but a different kind of, is it always positive?
Not always positive, because I'm a human being. I have negatives at times as well, but I think it's perspective. I think that's really important. I think it's, in terms of my mindset, it's very easy sometimes to get lost in the chaos of things. I think it's important to have perspective and have reflection. I think that's really important. I think, again, a bit of advice I could give to people that's helped me is almost be deliberate with when you have reflection in a week, and make sure that whether it's at the start of the week or the end of the week, but you have some time set aside to yourself where you can reflect on things and have perspective. I think that's really important, because your mindset will shift now and again. As human beings, it will. We don't have one setting in mindset. You have good days, you have bad days, you get angry, you get happy. But I think having a bit of perspective and reflecting on those things on a regular basis is really good, because you can start to make sense of things and tackle these things further afield once you have that time to reflect and weigh things up and have a degree of perspective. I think that helps you deal with future challenges as well.
No, perfect. Okay, thanks again, Kevin.
Thanks, Laurie. Appreciate it. Thank you.